panel here. Greg Prince has an MD. He's a pathologist. He has his own biotech company. He's got a PhD, and he's a researcher of renown. He's published a book which some of you have probably read, Power from On High, The Development of Mormon Priesthood, and he's spent 6 years so far working on another book, and that will be a substantial piece of research, and no doubt we'll all look forward to reading that when it comes forth. Our respondent, Stan Larson, is known to many of you Sunstone people. When I counted his publications and things that he's edited, it added up to 30. Stan has a new book coming out in November called Can Science Be Faith Promoting? And he and his wife had the book, The Missionary Diaries of David O. McKay, which they edited. So we have two real experts here today. I'll turn the time over now to Greg Prince, and I'll remind you if in the question period that if you can't come to the podium to use a mic or to one of the tables, then your questions need to be repeated to get them on the tape.
I think the answer on fundraising is that all notes of protest should be written on the back of a $20 bill. On a spring day in 1955, a group of distinguished gentlemen gathered at a White House dinner at the request of President Dwight Eisenhower. The guests included founding partners of three law firms, the president of the Teamsters Union, three Army generals, a cabinet secretary, the publisher of the Boston Globe, the vice president of ABC, the chairman of CBS, the president of MIT, four CEOs, and one clergyman, David O. McKay, president of the Latter-day Saint Church. Following a tour of the White House led by President Eisenhower, the group moved towards the dining room. President McKay described the scene. As we came through the hallway, a secretary approached with the plan of the table and the place where each would sit. As I came, he said, "President McKay, your place is just opposite the president's. This seat directly across from the President of the United States is the honor seat." Just before we took our seats, President Eisenhower came up to me and said, "President McKay, your seat is just opposite mine, and just before we take our seats, I should like to have you say grace." President McKay consented. After the prayer, a gentleman seated next to him started a conversation. He said, "You mentioned in your grace the freedom of the individual. Is that fundamental?" I said, "Next to life itself." He was a Presbyterian by training. He said, "They crowded me so much I have finally left churches. But," he said, "I believe in that freedom of the individual and developing oneself." I said, "That is fundamental in the Mormon Church." To understand David O. McKay's reverence for the principle of free agency is to understand the basis of ordinary tenure as president of the church, as well as the high esteem in which countless thousands to this day, both within and without the church, continue to hold him. Although President McKay's feelings about free agency were lifelong, they were heightened in the mid-1930s by the growing menace to world order of Soviet communism under the leadership of Joseph Stalin. On Independence Day 1936, the first presidency, of which President McKay was a member, published its first statement warning of the dangers of communism, stating in part, "The church does not interfere and has no intention of trying to interfere with the fullest and freest exercise of the political franchise of its members under and within our Constitution. But communism is not a political party nor a political plan under the Constitution. It is a system of government that is the opposite of our constitutional government, and it would be necessary to destroy our government before communism could be set up in the United States. Communism undertakes to control, if not indeed to proscribe, the religious life of the people living within its jurisdiction. Such interference would be contrary to the fundamental precepts of the gospel and to the teachings and order of the church." World War II pushed American concerns over Soviet communism to the background, but the onset of the Cold War renewed President McKay's concerns, central of which was communism's suppression of the principle of individual free agency. In dedicating a chapel in Wisconsin in 1954, he addressed the issue publicly. A wire service article reported, "President David O. McKay said Sunday that communist rulers will fall if they continue to rob people of their free choice between good and evil. President McKay said he believes persons under communist domination will revolt because their leaders have tried to take away their most valuable possession, free will. Speaking at the dedication of a new Madison Branch Chapel, President McKay said, "No power on earth can take this freedom away." He said the communists are trying to, but will not succeed. When a group claims that you and I are not free as individuals, you may rest assured that their philosophy is on a sandy foundation, he said. 3 years later, in a meeting with Senator and future President John F. Kennedy, he reiterated this theme. Speaking of Khrushchev and Soviet communism, President McKay said, "They are fundamentally wrong. Free agency is inherent in every individual. Rule by force has been fought against by men throughout history." Kennedy replied, "They have the power to continue. Their prospects for the immediate future are bright." To which President McKay rejoined, "I have hoped for 20 years that they would break up, and I do not see how they can last. It is just wicked to dominate men in that way." But it was not just the threat of communism that he abhorred. It was any threat to an individual's free agency, whether from a government, an organization, including a church, or an individual. Speaking to his driver, Darcy Wright, one day, President McKay quoted from memory the verses from the Doctrine and Covenants that warn of such a threat. "We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. Hence, many are called, but few are chosen. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned." Then he added, "That section alone is proof that the prophet Joseph Smith was one of the great. There is no question about it." He developed this thought in a public sermon reported by the Deseret News. Declaring the divine right of man to freedom of choice, President David O. McKay said, "There was never a time in the history of mankind when the evil one seemed so determined as now to strike at this fundamental virtue of free agency." The church leader told a congregation of nearly 1,000 persons that he stressed this fundamental principle of the gospel because he thought it was one of the most vital problems facing the world today, and particularly vital to members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. "God has given us our free agency," President McKay said, "and any nation or any group in any nation, our nation included, that will take from an individual that right, freedom of thought, freedom of action, is acting contrary to the will of God. There is that in the spirit of man which will rebel against it, against tyranny." To speak of free agency is noble, but to practice it in one's own backyard is the measure of one's character, particularly when doing so exacts a price. Yet time and again he showed his true character as he placed free agency first, even when those around him felt otherwise. I will present 8 case studies, 4 of which involved the liberal side of the ideological spectrum, and 4 of which involved the conservative side. In each case, the central issue was free agency. Case number 1. One of the great figures in Mormon historiography, and considered by some to have been the brightest intellect ever produced within the state of Utah, Juanita Brooks published in 1950 a landmark history of the Mountain Meadows Massacre that remains one of the classics of Mormon history, and after a half century is still in print. In sharp contrast to the accolades given the book by the historical community was the icy reception of some general authorities of the church, including an unsuccessful attempt to have its publication stopped. Once published, however, the quality of its scholarship led the Lee family to petition President McKay for the reinstatement to membership of their ancestor, John D. Lee, whose role in the massacre had led to his excommunication. President McKay set up a committee chaired by Apostle Delbert Stapley to investigate the matter. Based upon the committee's recommendation, President McKay authorized Lee's reinstatement, although he strongly counseled the Lee family that knowledge of this action be held in confidence. Brooks complied with this wish in the small first printing of her John D. Lee biography, but shortly thereafter included notice of it in the second printing. Incensed by what he felt to be a breach of trust, Stapley recommended that Brooks be excommunicated. President McKay's response was brief and unequivocal: "Leave her alone." Several years after the fact, a stake president related to Brooks for the first time this story as it had been related to him by Apostle Stapley. In the words of that stake president, In this life, I was not permitted to see the plates of the Nephites, but I did see the tears in Juanita Brooks' eyes when I told her of President McKay's instruction to leave her alone. Again, it was never mine to handle the plates, but Sister Brooks thrust out both of her hands, and I took them firmly in mind. No words were exchanged, none were necessary. Study number two. In 1952, Sterling McMurrin, a professor of philosophy at the University of Utah, met with two senior apostles at their request to discuss his religious beliefs. Entirely candid in his responses to their inquiries, he readily professed himself to have heretical beliefs while simultaneously remaining an active church member. Alarmed at his beliefs, they initiated a series of events that resulted 2 years later in McMurrin's bishop making a decision to call a church court to put him on trial for his membership. Although McMurrin resigned himself to letting events unfold as they may, his close friend, Apostle Adam Bennion, reacted swiftly to news of the impending judicial proceedings. Bennion informed President McKay of the matter, and he in turn placed a phone call to McMurrin to request that the two of them meet privately. In a 90-minute meeting at the University of Utah, McMurrin responded to the questions asked of him, but made no attempt to ask for President McKay's intervention. McMurrin later recounted the concluding portion of that meeting. President McKay said, "They cannot put you on trial." And I said, "Well, President McKay, you know better than I what they can do, but it appears to me that they are going to put me on trial." He said, "They cannot do it." And then there was a rather long pause, and he said, "Well, all I can say is, if they put you on trial for excommunication, I will be there as the first witness on your behalf." He said, "I have only one piece of advice to give you, just one piece of advice. It is the advice that my uncle gave me." President McKay indicated that this uncle was kind of a non-conforming member of the family and a non-conforming member of the church. "Now, when I was just leaving to go on my mission, we were down at the station. People were down there telling the missionaries goodbye, and my uncle shook hands with me and said, 'Now, David, I have just one piece of advice to give you. Just one piece of advice. Don't you ever let anybody tell you what to think or what to believe. You just think and believe as you please.' And President McKay said, 'Now, that's my advice to you. Don't ever let anybody tell you what to think or what to believe.'" In a follow-up letter, McMurrin wrote, "You have always been a symbol to me, as to countless others, of the religion that reaches out to include rather than to exclude, that unites rather than divides, that is concerned with large moral and spiritual issues." Several weeks later, without mentioning any names, President McKay used the forum of General Conference to send to the entire church the message that he sent to McMurrin. "Ours is the responsibility to proclaim the truth that each individual is a child of God and important in his sight, that he is entitled to freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, that he has the right to worship God according to the dictates of his conscience. In this positive declaration, we imply that organizations or churches which deprive the individual of these inherent rights are not in harmony with God's will, nor with his revealed word." The intent of his message was not lost on his audience. 4 days later, M. Lynn Bennion, superintendent of Salt Lake City Schools, wrote the following letter to President McKay. "Our recent conference impressed upon me more than ever that religion is a constant struggle between the formalistic and the traditional on the one hand, and the unending stimulation of the spirit. Your conference messages are based on laws and commandments, but the great stress is upon love, freedom, and compassion. I want to congratulate you again on your prophetic leadership. There is a fundamental issue at stake in the case being formulated against Sterling McMurrin. You expressed it directly when you spoke of man's right of freedom to think and to worship within the church. God bless you for taking this stand. It is our most precious possession and worth every sacrifice to maintain. I noted with joy that a number of the brethren caught your spirit and spoke in the same vein." Although many are familiar with parts of this story, it is more complex and more subtle than most people appreciate. It is true that President McKay's offer to be a witness in McMurrin's behalf immunized him from church judicial action, not only then, but also for the remainder of his life. In making the offer, however, President McKay was defending a principle. the free agency of the individual to think as he wished without adverse ecclesiastical reaction, without condoning McMurrin's beliefs and actions. Indeed, in a conversation a short time later with Ernest Wilkinson, president of Brigham Young University, President McKay expressed his disapproval of McMurrin's vocalization of his heretical beliefs and his irritation at McMurrin's having made known to others the content of what had been a private conversation. Furthermore, he clearly differentiated McMurrin's status as a professor at a state university from that of professors at BYU, whom he held to a much higher standard of conduct. Wilkinson recorded in his diary the essence of that meeting. I said I had heard that President McKay had had a conference with Sterling McMurrin and had told McMurrin that there was plenty of room in this church for diverse religious beliefs, and further said that if any excommunication proceedings were ever held, President McKay would appear as a witness in his favor. I further said that in the eyes of the dissident McMurrin group, he, President McKay, was now being held up as their idol. I told him that I felt I ought to report to him what was being represented as to his views. President McKay replied that there was all the difference in the world between whether a man should be excommunicated because he may not accept all the views of the church and whether he should still be employed on the faculty of BYU. He told me that I would have his complete support in refusing to renew the contracts of any teachers who did not teach the doctrines as they were interpreted by the leaders of the church. He expressed disappointment that McMurrin had been around telling of his private conversation. He told me that McMurrin himself had proposed that he believed in the church. He told me further that he had told McMurrin that McMurrin should not have stated the things he did to President Smith and Brother Lee, and McMurrin agreed that he should not have done so. Perhaps because of McMurrin's breach of etiquette, the two men never met privately again. However, although President McKay later commented to his counselors that he was disturbed over McMurrin's subsequent statements and attitude toward the church policy on blacks and priesthood, he never made it known publicly and never failed to defend McMurrin's right to hold such views. Study number three. At one time a teacher and author in the church education system, O.C. Tanner had long since parted company philosophically with the conservative faculty who came to dominate the system. When to his surprise a request came in 1955 from the General Sunday School Superintendency that he author a Sunday School manual. Initially, he turned down the request, not knowing that it had originated at a higher level. He later recounted, "After my negative reply, I had my hand on the doorknob, and I was about to leave, aware that when I opened the door, I would have turned down an opportunity which I might later wish I had accepted. At that moment, Superintendent Hill asked his associates, 'Should we tell him?' They replied affirmatively. He said, 'We have been to President McKay and asked him to give us the name of someone who could write the best text for our college-age Sunday school classes on the subject of Christ's teachings. Without hesitation, he mentioned you as the one who could do this.' I must say this surprised me. I loved President McKay. I had seen him in many circumstances, and I thought he always came through with intelligence, perception, and compassion. He had spoken at my Stevens funeral in 1949. I was not about to turn him down on anything he might ask me to do. I went back to where I had been sitting in front of them and replied that if President McKay asked me to do this, then I certainly would comply with his request." As he set about the task, however, doubts came to his mind. His wife described the episode. "President McKay requested that Obert write Christ's Ideals for Living. But he didn't think he could, for he said, 'President McKay, I don't think I could pass the reading committee, because I'm quite a liberal Mormon.' And what do you think President McKay said? 'Then we'll change the reading committee.' And they did." The Sunday school manual that Tanner authored, Christ's Ideals for Living, became the most widely distributed and arguably finest manual ever written for the Sunday school. Study number four. Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, began publication in 1965 and soon came to the attention of the First Presidency. After discussing the subject with his counselors, President McKay recorded that it was the sentiment at that time that we do not think it wise to oppose it nor to support it. That settled the subject in his mind, but not for some of his associates. In a later meeting of the Church Board of Education, A senior apostle spoke on the subject, as reported later by a board member and general authority present at that meeting. Well, that book, Dialogue, has no value in the world. In fact, if I had my way, I would burn the book. Just like that. Well, President McKay sits up and says, "Brethren, in this church, we do not burn books. But if we did, we ought to burn some that have been written around this table." Study number 5. President McKay's feelings about free agency and tolerance were not reserved for the liberal wing of the church. In 1954, Joseph Fielding Smith, the senior member of the Quorum of the Twelve, published a book entitled Man, His Origin and Destiny. Outspokenly critical of science in general and of biological evolution in particular, the book raised serious concerns among Latter-day Saint scientists and among Institute of Religion teachers who were being told that they had to teach it in their classes. Several Institute teachers took their case directly to President McKay, who was disturbed to find out that the book was being promoted without having been passed by the reading committee of the general authorities. Seeing that damage was being done by the way in which the book was being used, he commented privately to the teachers and later to individual scientists who inquired that the book should be treated merely as the views of one man. It is true that one man is president of the 12 and makes it more or less authoritative, but it is no more to be taken as the word of the church than any other unauthorized book. Furthermore, he said that so far as evolution is concerned, the church has not made any ruling regarding it, and that no man has been authorized to speak for the church on it. It would be easy to interpret this episode as a criticism by President McKay of President Smith, but it was not. Indeed, the two men had the highest respect and love for each other, having served together as general authorities for over 40 years at that time. It was not the publication of the book that caused President McKay's reaction. Rather, it was a combination of its unauthorized use as an Institute textbook, not having been approved for such by the reading committee, and the fact that its views concerning evolution, on which the church had not taken an official position, were being advanced as the church position. There is no record of a reprimand to President Smith, nor was there ever any public statement by President McKay concerning the book. Rather, he handled the matter quietly and privately, not ducking the issue when confronted with it by church members, but not dealing with it in such a way as to inhibit in any way President Smith's ability to carry out his sacred calling as president of the Quorum of the Twelve. Study number 6. 4 years later, Bruce R. McConkie, a member of the First Council of 70, took it upon himself to write an encyclopedic work that, because of his own church office and the book's title, Mormon Doctrine, quickly came to be regarded by many as the official position of the church. It soon became apparent to President McKay that the book, which consistently employed authoritative language, was causing damage among many church members, who mistook it as representing official church policy, and among many non-members, particularly Roman Catholics, who took great offense at the way their church was portrayed. Indeed, Dwayne Hunt, the Catholic Bishop of Salt Lake City, approaching a newly elected Latter-day Saint congressman with book in hand and tears on his cheeks, said, "Why did you do this to us? We are your friends." Not willing to act precipitously, President McKay asked two senior members of the Quorum of the Twelve to read and report on the book. Several months later, they met with the First Presidency and submitted their reports, which stated that the manuscript had not been submitted to the reading committee prior to publication, was written without the knowledge of Elder McConkie's father-in-law, Joseph Fielding Smith, and contained over 1,000 errors that, quote, affected most of the 776 pages of the book, end quote. There were several ways in which the matter could have been handled, all of which would have caused Elder McConkie public embarrassment and interfered with his ability to carry out his calling. Instead, President McKay chose a course of action that addressed the damaging aspects of the book while still respecting the free agency of its author and not undermining his position as a general authority. It was agreed that the necessary corrections are so numerous that to republish a corrected edition of the book would be such an extensive repudiation of the original as to destroy the credit of the author, that the republication of the book should be forbidden, and that the book should be repudiated in such a way as to save the career of the author as one of the general authorities of the church. Not wishing to place Elder McConkie in an awkward position in front of his fellow general authorities, President McKay and his counselors met privately with him to inform him of their decision, thus succeeding in avoiding a, quote, rebuke that would be embarrassing to him and lessen his influence with the members of the church, end quote. 8 years after its initial publication, Mormon Doctrine was published in a second edition containing hundreds of changes that address some, though not all, of the major areas of concern with the first edition. Study number 7. A different dilemma was presented to President McKay with the writing of a Melchizedek priesthood manual by Hugh Nibley. I'll let Nibley relate the incident in his own words. I wrote the priesthood manual for 1957, you know, an approach to the Book of Mormon. Well, there was a reading committee on it. Adam S. Bennion was the head of the committee. The reading committee wiped out every lesson in the book. Now, this is one thing in which I'm greatly obliged to President McKay. They kicked out every lesson in the book. They said it was over people's heads. And every time President McKay overruled them, the book is exactly as I wrote it. They wanted to make hundreds of changes and get rid of the whole thing entirely, and President McKay said, no, if it's beyond their reach, let them reach for it. Adam S. Bennion said, it's over their heads, and President McKay said, let them reach for it. Now, there's a great man. I liked that. Study number 8. In commemoration of the 1947 centennial of the pioneers' entry into the Salt Lake Valley, the church commissioned a play entitled Promised Valley. In 1961, the church staged a revival of the play in Kingsbury Hall on the University of Utah campus. President McKay reported on the attempt of one senior church official to censor the revived production. Claire, President McKay's secretary, called me at the apartment and said that Elder Ezra Taft Benson had called and left a message that he was greatly concerned over what had been reported to him about the MIA play Promised Valley. He said that he has heard that in one scene there is, quote, too much kissing, end quote, and in the sparkin' on a Sunday afternoon scene, it's not what it should be. I told her that we would judge that after we had seen it this afternoon. 5 o'clock p.m. Sister McKay and I attended the MIA's production of the play Promised Valley, held in the Kingsbury Hall, University of Utah campus. The original of this production was composed by Dr. Crawford Gates at the request of the Centennial Commission, of which I was chairman in 1947. I was, therefore, very interested in seeing this musical again after all these years. It received wide acclaim at the time. Sister McKay and I thought this production by amateurs was wonderful, and much credit should be given to the MIA drama directors for the excellence of the entire play. There was nothing in it that could be criticized. By not rushing to judgment on the basis of hearsay and by viewing the production from his own vantage point, he prevented an unjustified and probably damaging censorship that would have sent the wrong message to the community. The fact that these 8 studies are equally divided among the conservative and the liberal sides of the spectrum is potent evidence that President McKay's concern was not to favor one ideology over another, but to ensure that all points on the spectrum were given access to free agency, as well as receiving protection from those who would have constricted that free agency. His was an inclusive church, not an exclusive one, perhaps the most inclusive it had ever been. He was not threatened by diversity. Indeed, he appreciated, as few others have, the strength that comes from diversity. Having spent his formative years on a farm, he understood from his own observations the dangers of inbreeding. And even his choice of general authorities reflected that understanding, as he surrounded himself with ardent conservatives, true liberals, and everything in between. However, his tolerance of diversity did not necessarily translate to approval, a distinction not appreciated by all recipients of his largesse. For example, he did not approve of Sterling McMurrin's self-described heretical viewpoints and would not have tolerated their having been taught at BYU. Neither, however, did he share Joseph Fielding Smith's anti-evolution beliefs and would not allow them to be advanced as official church position. But in all 8 case studies, whether or not he agreed with the beliefs, thoughts, or actions of the individual, he defended the exercise of free agency and intervened only when such exercise was threatened or when the church officer's words and actions caused sufficient institutional repercussions to require damage control. Even in those extreme cases, the damage control was buffered so as to minimize its negative impact on one's ability to continue in his church calling. His was truly a universal church, and we remain indebted to him 30 years after his death for establishing so lofty a standard. One of the most eloquent and profound of the many tributes that followed President McKay's death, written by Sterling McMurrin, highlighted the importance of his universality. It read in part, "Universality as a religious ideal is possible only where there is an authentic conception of the reality of the individual, a genuine concern for his dignity and worth, and a full measure of human sympathy. It was not an accident that Jeremiah, who may have been the first of the prophets to declare unequivocally that there is only one God and that he is the God of all men and all nations, was also the first to clearly champion the moral freedom and responsibility of the individual. Nor was it an accident that in teaching that Christ came to save all men, Paul declared that each is precious in the sight of God. I believe that the universalism of President McKay, his identification with humanity, was grounded in his respect and concern for the individual, his reverence for the freedom and autonomy of the moral will, his sympathy and compassion for every person." End quote. McMurrin would have been pleased but not surprised to hear President McKay make this point when he said to his secretary one day, quote, "Men must learn that in presiding over the church, we are dealing with human hearts, that individual rights are sacred, and the human soul is tender. We cannot run the church as we would run a business." I continue and conclude with McMurrin's tribute. My point then is a very simple one, that President David O. McKay, whom we knew and loved as a charismatic leader and friend, combined the virtues of kindliness, compassion, love, and profound commitment to the moral and intellectual freedom of every person with a strong consciousness of the unity of mankind and the ideal possibilities of human brotherhood. We may hope that future historians will find that his ideal was, in fact, the beginning of a new era for the church.
I appreciate very much Greg's analysis of President McKay and his choice of these eight examples are very good, four on each side. Though I think that that's to Greg's benefit, that this has showed the balance. President McKay was certainly balancing between the different both sides of the theological spectrum, but I really think that if you did some kind of a statistical analysis of these cases, you'd find that there were substantially fewer on the liberal side that that got successfully resolved. Partly that's because President McKay, though he was concerned and balanced his own first presidency and the brethren as best he could, was president of the church and earlier, of course, an apostle in the first presidency for years and years and years, but very concerned about that public image of the church. And so that's one of the things that I'd like to talk about, a couple of these instances on how those things relate. For example, probably the best case, the best well-known one, is the Sterling McMurrin episode in which President McKay literally came to his defense and was willing to act as a witness if an excommunication was proceeded with. The thing that's interesting about that is that, and you probably aren't aware of this, but actually, to Greg's credit, he didn't just use the Jack Newell interview that's recently been published, but also in a few years ago, talking to Sterling, had access to a series of tapes, not interview, but an oral history that Sterling had with all the documents relating to this, actually put it onto tape, and so it's a 15 years earlier, even better account of how this occurred. But the interesting thing about that, of course, is that, and I don't know, partly, Sterling McMurrin knew David O. McKay. They were friends. And it's a rare thing today to have that kind of a close relationship with one of the brethren, let alone the president of the church. He was willing to come to his aid, and I'm sure he would have done that. But nowadays, people that have liberal standings, it's rare that they would be able to go to the president of the church and say, "Here, I've got this problem. How can you help me?" You don't have that kind of contact, and that's unfortunate. I think one of the case that was mentioned about changing the reading committee, if it didn't work the way you wanted, the brethren can do that. On the opposite side, one little comment on my own situation, I used to work for the LDS Church in Translation, and I had written a paper that hadn't been published, but I just written it, and I was called in to a meeting, and the question was, did I write this? It was an analysis of the Book of Mormon relationship and the Sermon on the Mount to the biblical account. The point was simply, had I written it? And I said yes. And they told me, well, we have been instructed that this is to be the end of your employment. And I remember talking a little bit about, well, because we talked a little bit about bishops and stake presidents and so forth, and I said, well, it's unfair that my particular bishop, who doesn't know any of these issues, would be concerned about that. And I was thinking then of a bishop that I knew at BYU, and said, how, what if I had that bishop there? And he said, well, we'll just change the bishop. You know, we can do that. So these things can happen on both sides of the spectrum. One other case that I wanted to comment on a little bit was Joseph Fielding Smith. And of course, that's on the other side. And his publication in 1954 of Man, His Origin and Destiny. The thing that's perhaps not so well known about the publication of that book in 1954 is that it was essentially written in the 1930s. And if you look back, if you look through and say, well, let's examine all the quotations and the sources, those published after 1931, there's very few of them. It was mostly written by 1931. And the thing that's not so well known is that Joseph Fielding Smith, the reason he had essentially written that at that time was in response to the conflict with B.H. Roberts, who himself had written a manuscript known as The Truth, the Way, the Life, what he considered his most important work, and he wanted it published. And there was loggerheads over a number of things. Probably the most well-known was B.H. Roberts feeling that there had to be pre-Adamites. That is, that the fossil evidence of humans, Homo sapiens and Homo erectus and all the other various kinds of species is very convincing, big point of view. And so he said B.H. Roberts said there had to be this pre-Adamite period. Well, anyway, the point is that Joseph Fielding Smith took the opposite point of view and was against that and was very much against organic evolution, and his manuscript showed that. But the brethren, in discussing it and talking about it, finally decided this would have been April in 1931, and in fact had a seven-page letter to not just the two participants, B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith, but to all the general authorities, and gave them each a copy, and essentially said, we don't know which it is, and therefore we are not to talk about it anymore, either way, that it is or that it isn't. And so what happened is that no one, the rule was that they weren't supposed to talk about this anymore, and then what happened, of course, is that a couple years later, B.H. Roberts passed away in 1933, and then James E. Talmage, who was a mediator in some ways, a scientist who was a geologist, and he died in 1933. And it happened that all the brethren involved, and the presidency of the church, of course, that gave this issue, this proclamation to all of them, had passed away by the early 1950s. Then Joseph Fielding Smith, he survived them all, and he was then, I guess, allowed to go ahead and do it, because he did, and the book was published on his own. And part of the problem, this is just a fact of life, is that once a book is published, it's out there and available for people. And so that was the awkward thing for President McKay. It was published, and people were taking it as the official position of the church. And of course, it wasn't. It wasn't the president or the presidency's position or the church's position. It was Joseph Fielding. But most members reading a book don't make that distinction, and so that was the difficulty between them. Greg also mentioned on the case with Bruce R. McConkie and Mormon Doctrine, the report by two of the brethren on that issue, I can't quite understand how it could be true that Joseph Fielding Smith had no knowledge of Bruce R. McConkie's book. Now, I'm sure wasn't involved in writing it, and maybe didn't read a text of it, but I can't imagine Bruce R. McConkie not having told his father-in-law that he was doing this. I don't know. But that's probably what the report said, but it stretches my belief to think that that would be the case, because they both were basically the same position on that issue. What I'd like to do in just a couple minutes is to take what has been discussed here in terms of David O. McKay and these issues, and look back at an earlier David O. McKay. And we have the advantage of this opportunity to read David O. McKay's diaries, not as a general authority, not as a president of the church, or as an apostle, but as a young LDS missionary. And you can look back and see what he was like as he went through the actions of being a missionary. For example, he starts out on his mission. And by the way, that quote about what his uncle's advice was as he left to go on his mission is actually not stated specifically in his diaries. I'm sure that it occurred, but he doesn't, as you know, you don't write everything that happens in your diaries. But as he began his mission, for example, he said he didn't like tracting, and yet he was supposed to do it, so he went ahead and did it because he was supposed to do it, and then a few weeks later he would talk about the good experiences that he had in tracting. Well, we could go through a number of instances how he knew and he saw instances of the importance of free agency, and also that people had to have the right to make a wrong choice. And as he developed, you can see a number of cases where he worked with people that fell into moral transgression, and tried to work with them and help them through it and help them repent and change their life, or in various kinds of apostasy. He often didn't talk about specifically what the problem was, but sometimes he would. He would be quite forthright in a number of the things. But you could see him growing through this. Even there was a case where a young girl fell in love with a member of the church, and David O. McKay didn't think he was very good, but he said he had counseled the mother and the daughter that the daughter should not do this. But he wrote in there that here was a chance for her. She had to take responsibility for her own actions, and she could do as she wished, and he just wished it would turn out. One interesting thing, I'd like to just quote a short statement that he made that shows, again, him as he's in his mid-20s as a missionary. And this is after he had been there a little over a year, and it was on January 1st of 1899. So it wasn't so much a New Year's resolution as a looking back at the previous year that he had been a missionary. He said, One year ago, I sat in silent meditation, wondering where I would be and how I would be feeling 1 year hence. Well, here I am, about the same lad as of old. The experience of the last year has been many and varied, and I hope profitable. They have taught me to appreciate the truths of the gospel and to feel thankful that I was born of kind, loving parents in the valleys of the mountains, among a people who are in morals, freedom of thought, and true religion, lead the world. So he talked a little bit about his own tradition and his family upbringing and the importance of having freedom of thought. Though, again, and this is where we're going to have a couple instances here where, because David O. McKay, in his youthful missionary account, is honest, today we would look back and say, well, he's pretty intolerant. And case here earlier, in that same year that he was looking back at, in which this was in March of 1898, he said, attended services. This was a Sunday. Attended services at the Free Church, Reverend Angus Pastor. Long prayers and vain repetitions grated on my nerves. He thanked God for his tired and weary heart. I felt to thank him for my merry, lightsome heart, made so by the freedom of the gospel and of our Savior as revealed in this dispensation. So you see, part of this was his youthfulness, and one of the values, it seems to me, is that you see him growing through the experience throughout this period. One thing that was touched on a little by Greg was a statement that David O. McKay, and this would have been in the, as president of the church, disagreed with and was disturbed by Sterling McMurrin's comments on blacks in the priesthood. Two days ago, Mike Quinn quoted a statement in his paper of David O. McKay saying something about insolent Negroes wanting to have equal rights. I'm not sure the exact date of that, but it's unfortunate, but I think true, that David O. McKay, at least as a youth, and for a certain period of time as he even became mature, had racial feelings against black people. He would call them Negroes. He didn't call them niggers, but he called them Negroes. And we have also at the University of Utah not only his diaries that go right back to his missionary diaries, but also correspondence. And in some of the family letters, there are some disturbing things talked about blacks, just the way he referred to them. But on the very day, at the very first day of when he had crossed the United States and got on the ship. When he got on the ship, one of the things that he mentioned was he went into let me go back. It wasn't on the ship. I'll talk about that in a minute. It was on the train from Ogden. So when he first left, he went into the smoker, and the smoker was the room where people smoked. And he commented about how he didn't like that, and also the fact that there were Negroes there smoking. And then the reason I was talking about then going on the ship is that there was he met on the ship going across over to Great Britain a group of American singers. They were black from the South, and they sang several times, and he mentions them in the diary. And the thing that's interesting is after going then to Scotland, about 6 months later, this group was touring around England and Scotland and Wales and so forth. And he met them again, and he talked about, after seeing them again, he went up to congratulate them and was very nice about it. But then in his diary, he did comment and say, after talking about what he had just done and complimenting him on their singing, quote, "though I don't much care for the Negro." Now, what these things show is that he had certain racial prejudices that developed, that had, I guess, as a youth, and we need to put that into perspective, that not everything. President McKay, the reason I'm a little bit hesitant is because I look to him very much, and especially I think people that members of the church that are 50 or above that remember, or maybe in the mid 40s that remember President McKay. He did an awful lot for the church, and we're very thankful. But in some cases, there are things that we can see that he himself had to grow through. Perhaps I should end just by saying that on this very page, quoted about not liking that minister in the way he had approached his congregation, there's an illustration of a house with a stone. And the reason I mention that is that the theme that he mentioned many times was, "Whatever thou art, act well thy part." And this is the first time that picture, this is the actual house where that stone occurred. And it was published for the first time in this book. And the interesting thing, I think, about it, and this is, I'll end with this positive note on President David O. McKay, is that as a youth, as a missionary there, he had this experience and he talked about it. Not in his diary. It's never once mentioned in the diary, but it is mentioned in his letter of about a year later and several times throughout his career as an apostle and later as president of the church. But unlike Paul H. Dunn and his stories, when you begin to check them out, they don't work. And they were usually about Paul H. Dunn. This one was about David O. McKay, and we have been able to support it. And in fact, as you know, the very stone itself is here in Salt Lake at the Museum of Church History and Art. And so it has been confirmed that this did affect him. It didn't change his life the moment he saw that stone and decided that he needed to do his job as a missionary, because there were times where he said later on, "I feel a little bit guilty not going out and talking to the members or proselyting or doing something," and they would go to a play. And he about the fact that he felt a little guilty, and then the next week he'd be going to another play. So it was a growth process, but it is exciting, I think, to have the opportunity to be able to look at someone in that chronological way throughout his life, and you see real growth and development. So thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Greg or Stan? Yes. Stan, would you rephrase the question?
The question was, are there very many mentions of contact with Protestants and other churches during his mission experience? Most of the time, he would mention about going to different churches, and often just talks about who the minister was and maybe somewhat of the subject. Doesn't often discuss it. But what is interesting is that in his discussion, and again, going right back to the beginning of his mission, he talks about visiting with people, and often, I guess, just by the dynamics of life at the time, is that the men would be out working, and so when he was knocking on the doors, it was usually the women, the wives, and the people at home. But he was very impressed with how well they knew the Bible and commented on how little he knew, and it was an incentive for him to then go and study a little more to learn, because he was put in place a number of times with his lack of understanding. And then there were even times where one time he was quite depressed, and he used the word. He didn't ever use the word depressed, but he was blue, sad, gloomy, and so forth. And the thing that made him feel better was this non-member lady who he had talked to, a very Christian person, who complimented him on what he was doing and trying to bring the gospel to people. So you could see him grow through that experience.
Next.
I wonder if two of you would address that.
All right, for the tape, the question relates to whether President McKay's attitude on rift. Do you want to take it, Greg, first?
I think that unless you look at any process or any individual chronologically over time, it's very easy to misunderstand what's going on. I have kept a diary for the last 33 years, beginning at the same time that President McKay did when I went on my mission. and that diary is about 7,000 pages now. As I go back, and I did it 2 years ago for the first time, and reread what I wrote as a missionary, this looks tame. And to me, it was a little embarrassing, but I got over that quickly because it indicated that there had been some movement over the years. If you lift out of context what somebody said or thought in the earlier years, it's very easy to paint an inappropriate picture of what that person actually became, and it becomes very tricky. You have to know when things were said or written and what the circumstances were and what the cultural milieu was in which those things happened. We can think back to the 60s, many in this room, or the 50s or the 40s, and it was a different world then. If you can't place in that context what he said or wrote at those times, then you're doing him an injustice, and you will misunderstand what he eventually became. His views, for instance, on women's issues look very anachronistic now, but if you take them back 30 or 40 or 50 years and evaluate them in the environment in which he lived, you find out that generally he was very progressive in the context of his own times. It's unfair to any person to take a quotation from 50 or 100 years ago, put it under a magnifying glass made today, and say he was racist. That's absurd.
Stan, did you wish to comment?
Well, certainly I think that's very true, that you've got to look at things in the context and to be able to see a historical development, because people do change. My own mother, that I love very dear, was certainly a racist, and I don't know, we haven't talked about the subject since, or much lately, but I remember as a little kid growing up, and I apologize ahead of time, it doesn't look like there's any black or African Americans here, but I have to admit that in my innocence, I thought the Brazil nuts that I was eating had a different name because that's what they were called. They were called nigger toes. And that was what my father and mother taught me was the name of that particular nut. And I only found out years later, and I can't remember the circumstance of doing that, because that was how I grew up. So certainly you have to put things in that kind of a context. And David O. McKay was a young man, and he had this... this part was a line in his own life, but he certainly grew through it, and I think you have to do that. You can't just say this is what someone believes or said. You have to look at what time period it was. For example, one last little thing you mentioned about ideas about women. Several times in the 1890s on his mission, he was astounded at the number of problems that women had and how they were being beaten by their husbands. And he said in one case, after going home from a funeral, he gave the funeral sermon of I think she was probably in her mid-20s, maybe early 30s, who had passed away, and he delivered the funeral sermon. And then he says in his diary, "If I hadn't heard this from the person himself, I would not have believed it could ever occurred." But the husband, now a widower, was saying to David O. McKay on the way home, he said, "You know, I didn't treat her very well. I wasn't a very good husband. And when our first child was being born, while she was pregnant, I guess they had the beds that they would have to climb up into. But anyway, they had done this, and this was the way they did it in Scotland." He said, and then he quoted the Scottish brogue perfectly, David O. McKay did, something like, she said, "The baby's going to come. It's the middle of the night." And he said, "Oh, hold on, woman, wait till the morning." And she couldn't, and she started to get out of the bed, and the baby was born, and it fell and hit the leg of the bed, and from birth was deaf. And this was just one of the little instances that he told about what this father had confessed. And he said, "This is terrible, but I wouldn't have believed that someone who was a human being would treat his spouse like that." So these things all have to be put in a context.
That brings, I'm sorry, our time is gone. You'll have to come up and ask him personally. Thank you very much.